Chapter 13. Present Day. This dinner party will be very different from the one we had a few weeks ago. I'm setting the table on the back patio, rather than the one in the dining room, since the weather is nice and the mosquitoes haven't gotten bad yet. Ryan is icing down the beer and wine we bought earlier, placing it in the decorative galvanized tub with Sumner etched across the front. Sarah gave him the tub on his last birthday. If there is one thing I've learned over the years, it's that Southerners believe the best gift is a personalized gift. James and that woman arrive just as Ryan is firing up the grill. We both greet them as they make their way up the short set of stairs to the deck. Ryan takes one of the 12-packs James is lugging while she hands me a foil-covered platter and says, "I know you said don't bring anything, but James's mom and I made way too many brownies this afternoon." I pull the edge of the foil back to peek. "Oh, yum, these smell divine." I'm already visualizing the Facebook post Mrs. Bernard has probably already uploaded.
"How's your dad's leg?"
Ryan asks James as they shake hands.
"Getting better," James answers. "Or at least getting better at not complaining about it."
The woman lets out a laugh while nudging James with her elbow. "Stop, he's a far better patient than his son would be." She turns to me. "There's a never-ending poker game now that he's stuck at home. He's running out of friends who are willing to lose money to him." Her hand falls gently on Ryan's arm. "I know he'd love for you to stop by for a visit. Maybe lose a hand or two to keep his spirits up." She's got both men hanging on her every word within minutes of arriving.
"It's not hard for Ryan to lose at cards," James says.
I laugh just enough that it sounds genuine, then gesture for everyone to take a seat at the table while Ryan adds the beer James brought to the tub. "I'll just be a second," I say, then step inside to grab the appetizers I made earlier. Once I sit back down, I take a deep breath and soak everything in. It's a gorgeous night, with weather Louisiana is seldom blessed with, warm and breezy with no humidity. It's a shame to waste such a perfect evening on work. The conversation is easy, with the guys doing most of the talking. She seems to approach this sort of thing the same way I do. Listen and learn.
"We're hogging the conversation," Ryan says with a laugh after a bit, then turns to the woman sitting next to James. "I'd love to learn more about the newest addition to Lake Forbing."
"Yes, we didn't get much of a chance to talk at the derby party. Luca, it's hard to say her name out loud. My name. It felt as bitter on my tongue as I thought it would." She shrugs and sends James a warm smile. "Not much to tell. James and I met a few months ago. We both were working in Baton Rouge. I'm an insurance adjuster and was there following up on a group of claims from the tornado that tore through last fall."
"Yeah, that was a bad one," Ryan says. "I have a couple of clients there. Lots of homes were destroyed."
"It was tragic." She reaches over and slips her hand into James's. "Makes you really appreciate everything you have." It takes everything in me to keep my sweet smile and engaged expression locked into place. "So you just move from disaster to disaster?" I ask. She cringes. "Pretty much. It gets hard sometimes, but there are breaks in between, like right now. There's nowhere I need to be, so I can handle the paperwork from anywhere." Another loving glance at James, and another squeeze of his hand. But he's too busy downing the rest of his beer with his free hand to notice. She's good. The backstory is solid. Delivery is flawless. Facial movements match her emotions. I'm impressed. James, on the other hand, needs some coaching, although I'm pretty sure he's just a pawn. She's polished while he looks to be hanging on by a thread. I can't imagine any circumstance where this is actually a genuine relationship. I've been in her spot before, forcing something just for the sake of a job. The fact that she keeps looking at him like he's hung the moon makes me respect her more than I want to. She turns toward me and says, "James said you haven't lived here long, Evie. What brought you to Lake Forbing?" "Oh, I've been bouncing around for a while. My parents died in a car wreck a few years ago, and I needed a change of scenery." I bite down on my bottom lip and cast a glance at Ryan, my vulnerability making a quick appearance before I shove it back down. He scoots closer to me, resting his hand on my thigh.
ended up here and fell in love with this place. I'm a sucker for a cute small town, I say with a nervous laugh. And for a cute guy who's handy with minor car repairs. Ryan chuckles beside me.
Anything more than a tire change and I'll need to call in reinforcements.
She leans forward, grin stretching across her face. Speaking of cute small towns, who is your college friend from Eden, Evie? I'm sure I know her or her family. It would be hard not to in a town that size.
This bitch.
I match her smile. Regina West. She's got a younger sister, Matilda, and an older brother, Nathan, you may have known. We stayed at her house while we visited, but I couldn't tell you the street or neighborhood. Let's see how good she is and just how thorough the packet she was given on me was. Regina West was a girl I went to school with, but her family moved away in seventh grade. We were best friends growing up, and I would love to find out how much of my past Mr. Smith knows. Nathan moved back to Eden about 5 years ago, after he finished med school and opened a walk-in clinic there. There aren't many family doctors in that area, so he is very well known and respected in the community. Her brow creases as if she's struggling with how to answer me. That name does sound familiar. She trails off, leaving the rest of her sentence unfinished. Nope. I'm docking points. She obviously didn't do any of her own research and relied only on what Mr. Smith gave her. And she would have been briefed on Nathan if my early friendship with Regina had been discovered, because we were inseparable before she moved. I'm guessing Mr. Smith didn't uncover anything on me earlier than high school.
Is Eden still where you call home? Ryan asks. I would think your company wouldn't send you so far away for work.
I live in Raleigh now. Eden is a great place, but it's just really small, you know? She shrugs, then looks at me as if I'll agree with her. My company is short-staffed, so we're all stretched a little thin. I'm sent where I'm needed.
Both of you girls have moved around a lot, James says with a loud laugh. Evie, I'm guessing if you moved in with Ryan, you plan to stay a while. No more bouncing around? Or is this just a temporary stop? James, you're putting her on the spot.
Ryan's voice has a hint of the bite I heard a few days ago in his office at Glenview. She squeezes his hand hard enough that James squeaks out an ow. And then under his voice, he says to her quietly,
Thought you wanted to know if she's staying.
Yeah, there's no way he works for Mr. Smith, too. He's not even remotely good at this, and she needs to do a better job of keeping her pawn in line. It's a fair question, I say, ignoring his last comment. I wouldn't have accepted Ryan's invitation to move in if I had plans to move on. Ryan's thumb brushes softly across my leg, so I know he's pleased with my answer.
Once she sees the plans I'm working on for the vegetable garden and greenhouse, she won't be going anywhere. It will be a two-person operation, so she can't abandon me.
My attention snaps to him. You're putting in a garden? He shakes his head slowly, and his smile widens.
No.
A short pause, and then he says,
We're putting in a garden. You said you always wanted one.
The blush that blooms across my face is genuine, and I wish I didn't have to share this moment with the two other people at the table. She leans forward, breaking the spell between Ryan and me, and asks, Can you point me to the closest powder room, Evie? But Ryan is already standing up.
I'll show you. I'm heading in to grab the steaks. Need to get them on the grill now, or we'll be having them for breakfast.
She follows him inside, and I know she'll take this moment to snoop through our stuff. It's exactly what I would do. But more importantly, it's what I want her to do. I've left a little something for her to find that I know she'll report back to Mr. Smith. It's a dangerous play, but I need him to put all his cards on the table. I'm sick of surprises. The interesting thing about this situation is that I really can't tell if she knows I'm here on a job, just like her. Or is she working me like she would any unsuspecting mark? Did her set of instructions tell her the mention of Eden, North Carolina would set me on edge?
James, how do you like yours cooked?
Ryan calls out as he steps back onto the deck, holding a platter of marinated steaks and wearing an apron that says, You don't have to kiss me, but you could get me a beer.
Medium rare,
he answers, then moves to the grill.
I sip on my wine while I give that woman a few more minutes to rummage around in my things. Then I get up from the table. Looks like you forgot the veggies. I'll go grab them. Ryan gives me a nod, then turns back to James. I enter the kitchen, expecting to see her, but the room is empty. I glance at my watch. She's taking too long. Quietly, I move toward the stairs. As soon as I make it to the top, she's exiting the upstairs hall bathroom. I was afraid you got lost, I say. She lets out a shriek and jumps slightly back, her hand grabbing at her chest. Oh, I didn't see you there. Then her expression shifts into this endearing little grin. I got caught up admiring those cute family pictures on the stairwell wall on my way up. Ryan was an adorable little boy. I look back at the images in question and have to agree. He was a cutie. And bonus points to her for the save. It's a good excuse. She moves toward the stairs and waits, as if she will follow me. But I step to the side. I'll meet you down there. Just need to grab something from my room. She hesitates just a second, then smiles as she passes me. Once she's out of sight, I go to our room at the end of the hall. There's only one thing here she could find, and I hope she did. I move to the dressing table and open the drawer. Two pens and a pencil were arranged in a very specific way on top of a stack of papers, and she would have needed to brush them to the side in order to read what was written there. And it's obvious she did exactly that. I shut the drawer and go downstairs. I head back outside with the vegetables, handing the tray to Ryan. Then I light the candles I've scattered around the area now that the sun is fully set.
Everything should be ready soon,
Ryan says. Nodding, I say, perfect. I'll get the rest from the kitchen. It's not long before Ryan places a steak on each plate, along with a helping of grilled veggies, while I put garlic bread and a big salad in the center of the table. Everything looks delicious, she says. Y'all have outdone yourself. I cut a small piece of steak and bring it to my mouth, chewing it slowly. We love to entertain, I say, glancing at Ryan. He gives me that smirk, since we're both thinking of the 2 weeks it took him to convince me to host our last dinner party.
How much longer are y'all in town? Ryan asks.
She looks at James as if she doesn't know the answer.
Maybe another couple of weeks, he says. As soon as Dad can get around a little better on his own, I'll feel better about leaving. It's good you could take off this much time from work, Ryan says, then takes a swig of beer.
This is something he mentioned earlier this afternoon. His worry about why James was really back in town. If James had gotten his life together and was holding down a job like he said, it begged the question, how had he managed to get this much time off?
The beauty of working from a laptop, he says with a laugh. Can work anywhere.
What is it that you do, James? I ask. He looks at the woman as if she's the only one who knows the answer. She looks back at him with an expression that can only be described as hopeful that he doesn't completely screw up this answer. Finally, he turns back to us.
Luca actually got me a job at her company. I'm working for her.
He could have sold it better if he didn't sound so glum. Instead of us thinking they are equals at work, he sounds like a charity case. Ryan was not thrilled I'd invited them to dinner. He banged around in the garage for a good hour, then spent the rest of the afternoon hiding some of the obvious and easily movable valuables in the house, including my jewelry and any prescription meds he had in the medicine cabinet. The girls had mentioned James stole from Ryan the last time he was in town, but Ryan never admitted that to me. And you can't tell if there's beef between them by the way they are acting around each other now. Preparing for this evening was the most strained things have been between us. Regardless of what Ryan's fears and James's motives are, I'm only concerned with her. The rest of the dinner is consumed by small talk. Ryan matches James beer for beer until they're both pretty tipsy. She and I clear the plates while James and Ryan throw an old football around in the mostly dark backyard, both of them missing more than they are catching. She follows me inside, and we work through the dirty dishes and put away the leftovers. Mr. Smith told me why she's here, but she's too good an asset to waste as a reminder. And now that she riffled through my stuff, I know she's got an active role. She's not just one who observes. I decide to go on the offensive. Have you gotten your next set of instructions, or are you still checking your mailbox every day? My tone is conversational, and from the way the plate slips through her fingers into the sink, I know I've caught her off guard. But she recovers quickly. Confusion plays across her face when she says, "Instructions?" I don't expect you to answer, but I do expect you to pass along that I'm here to do my job, and I don't appreciate any interference. Her body language tells me she's genuinely surprised by my words, so I'm guessing she didn't know we share a boss. I lean a little closer. We have more in common than you know. The disbelief on her face is still there, but it's more controlled now. I'm sorry, I really don't know what you're talking about. The sheets on North Van Buren and Eden. What's the name of the side street? Her mouth opens slightly, but no words come out. It's East Stadium Drive. Same road that takes you to the high school. A road anyone in Eden would know without thinking about it, I say. Did you already send him a picture of what you found upstairs? Or will you do it when you get back to the Bernards? She flinches at the tone in my voice. I don't know. I lean in closer. Can we get to the part where you just answer my question? It's a tense minute, and then she says, I already sent him a picture of it. There would be no way for her to know that what she found was useless, only that it didn't belong in my dresser drawer and looked suspicious. That's all it would take for her to pass it back to Mr. Smith. And I couldn't resist the opportunity to let him know how I feel about her presence here. He knows I would never keep anything sensitive in this house. So I created a spreadsheet entitled Opera Guild Association Fundraiser, with a list of fake names and credit card numbers to symbolize the one I would have gotten from that auction at the country club if I hadn't gotten busted that night. It was enough to catch her attention, and Mr. Smith will know I set her up to find it. I don't appreciate him sending someone into my space. She starts to move away, then hesitates a second. How did you know? I was expecting you to search through my things, and I left it for you to find. But if I wasn't expecting it, I wouldn't have known. I'm not sure why I felt compelled to give her that little bit of praise, since we're not on the same side. I better check on James, she says. Just as we're almost at the door to the deck, I say, one last warning. It's not a big step from being on the job to becoming the job. There's more I want to say, but I've already said too much. And Mr. Smith won't like that I've spoken to her so candidly. She pushes the door open and says in that sugary sweet voice, James, honey, are you ready?
Yeah, babe. Ready when you are, he calls back.
Ryan and I walk them out, and I notice that things are not only strained between the two of us, but also between Ryan and James. The goodbyes are terse compared to the pleasantness we shared during dinner. She gets behind the wheel, since James could barely make it to the car on his own two feet, and we make eye contact as she starts the car. Ryan and I watch as they back out of the driveway. Something happened with James? I ask. Ryan tenses next to me.
Same old shit.
As soon as their headlights disappear around the corner, we walk hand in hand into the house. Chapter 14, Present Day. I'm up earlier than usual for a Sunday morning. The events of last night generated an endless parade of questions, ensuring I didn't sleep well. I slide out of bed, trying not to wake Ryan, and slip downstairs to the kitchen. I need to use the next couple of hours contemplating what to do while I wait for Mr. Smith's next move. I start the coffee machine before flipping on the small television in the breakfast nook. An old black and white movie hums along in the background while I stare at the steady drip of dark liquid. The rumble sundering down the stairs has me spinning in that direction. Ryan skids into the kitchen, his phone clutched to his ear. He snaps his fingers at me, then points at the TV. Covering the mouthpiece with his hand, he says,
"Put it on three."
He looks panicked.
"I'll call you back,"
he says, then ends the call. I change the channel, and the local newscaster fills the screen. She's on the side of the road, the warm glow of the rising sun behind her, highlighting the bridge that crosses the lake. The accident happened shortly after 11 last night. Authorities say the car was going at a high rate of speed when it swerved off the road, breaking through the guardrail at the foot of the bridge and crashing into the lake. When asked if the driver was impaired, police said they wouldn't have that answer until the toxicology results came back. The camera pans the scene, and a wave of nausea rolls through me. The same car that backed out of our driveway last night is currently being pulled out of the water by a huge tow truck. And then the picture from the derby party of James and the woman fills the screen. James Bernard and his companion, Luca Marino, were visiting from Baton Rouge. Both were pronounced dead at the scene, and the Bernard family was notified shortly after, the newswoman says. Holy shit. Then they cut back to the anchor desk.
Chrissy, this must be awful for Mr. Bernard's family.
And then Chrissy's on the split screen. Yes, Ed. Mr. Bernard's father is currently at home recovering from a fall, and his son, James, had come to help his mother with his care. They are asking for privacy during this very difficult time. We've made some calls to our affiliate station in Luca Marino's hometown of Eden, North Carolina, and we'll be sharing what we learn about her on this evening's broadcast. Ryan stares at the small screen with his hand over his mouth. His expression is blank, as if he's still processing what he's seeing. When the news moves to the next story, I shut the TV off. Ryan drops down in the closest chair, his head in his hands. I go to him, my fingers brushing through his long strands.
I can't believe this. We left things in a bad way last night. And now this? He's been a fuck up his whole life, getting into shit, stealing from me. But I thought maybe he was better. And then when we were playing around with that football last night, he asked me for money. I was drunk and I lost it. Told him I was done with him for good.
I don't say anything, just continue to stroke his hair while I consider how this could have happened and what it means.
We need to go see his parents, he says as he looks up at me. Was she drunk? Should we have stopped her from driving?
I shake my head, and it takes a moment for me to find my voice. No, she had two glasses throughout the night. She was fine to drive. I refuse to let him blame himself for any of this. This seems to give him some relief, but it's short-lived. He hops up from the chair like he was sitting on a spring.
I need to see his parents. His mom is going to be heartbroken. His dad, too. Fuck, the cops are going to want to talk to us.
He squeezes his eyes closed.
We were the last ones to see them alive. They'll have questions for us.
He's rambling, and I've got to center him, and hopefully talk him out of calling the cops. The absolute last thing I need is for the cops to know anything about me. One thing at a time. Let's get dressed and go visit James's parents. See if they need any help making the arrangements. We'll worry about the rest of it later. He nods as he walks in a tight circle in the middle of the kitchen.
Yeah, let's do that.
Then he stops.
What about Luca? Should we call her parents? Are you still in contact with your high school friend who has family there? Maybe she knows them.
Deep breath in. Hold it. Slowly release. Let's start with James's parents. They may have already called her family. He nods again, then sprints toward the stairs.
I can be ready in 10 minutes.
I drop down in the chair Ryan vacated.
Run.
Mentally, I'm hauling ass out of this town without looking back. Breathe. I need to think this through. I need to think about this as if I were Mr. Smith. Would he be willing to exert the time and energy it would take to groom her for this job, and use the connections he'd need to insert her here, only to kill her off just a short time after she arrived? The only way that scenario seems likely is if she completed the task she was sent to perform, and her usefulness had run its course. I don't see how that would have been possible. I came into this job knowing it was a test, not the first test he's given me in the 8 years I've worked for him. So I expected there was more going on here than I was originally told. The only thing that's certain is that woman's appearance here was linked to my boss's displeasure over my performance on my last job, and now she's dead. For now, I will accompany Ryan to James's parents' home, where we will provide comfort by telling them how happy James was in his last hours of life. I will learn everything I can about the woman who was sent here to impersonate me. I will hold Ryan's hand while he grieves the loss of his friend. Regardless of the harsh words, I know Ryan would rather James had not died in that car wreck last night. Death has a way of letting those hard feelings go. But most importantly, I will finish what I started.
Two cop cars are parked in front of James's parents' house when we pull up. I knew this was a possibility, although I was hoping they had already come and gone. Ryan parks on their street two houses down, the closest spot he can find. The Bernards live in an older neighborhood on the other side of the lake from Ryan, where the houses were built in the mid-80s, in various shades of brown brick with low-slung roofs and narrow driveways. There's a steady stream of people walking toward the front door, just as we are. Why are there so many people here right now? This seems like the kind of crowd that shows up to the funeral home, I whisper to Ryan as he maneuvers us through the crowd to the side of the house. I knew he and James grew up together, and he spent a lot of time here as a kid, so I'm not surprised he's bypassing the front door.
These are probably mostly neighbors and members of their church. It will be twice this at the funeral home visitation. A lot of these women keep a casserole in the freezer for just this occasion.
He looks back at me from over his shoulder and rolls his eyes, adding,
plus, they're here for the gossip.
Ryan lets us in through the side door, and we move down the narrow back hall toward the main living area. There are people wall to wall, and the low ceilings intensify the claustrophobic feel. A group of little old ladies wearing very official-looking name tags and matching smock aprons, probably the Bible Brigade from the Bernards Church, if I'm guessing right, scurry around offering water or coffee to those visiting as well as making sure the room stays tidy.
They aren't in here, Ryan mumbles,
then pulls me back into the hall and through another open doorway that leads to a small office. Rose Bernard's thin, frail body is wedged into the corner of an oversized chair, while Wayne Bernard is stuffed into a wingback chair next to her with his bum leg propped up on a small ottoman. One uniformed officer sits on a stool in front of them, while two other officers stand behind him. The cop's attention pivots to us the second we fill the doorway. Ryan and I both take a step back.
I'm sorry. We didn't mean to interrupt.
Mrs. Bernard lets out an anguished cry when she sees Ryan.
Don't leave,
she cries.
How did this happen, Ryan? Was he okay at your house last night? Did something happen?
Ryan moves into the room and crouches down next to her, his hands covering hers.
Nothing happened. He was great. They both were. I wouldn't have let them leave if I didn't think they were okay.
The officers share a look with each other when they realize the deceased were at our house before the crash. We've gone from random visitors to possible witnesses to their state of mind before the accident. Mrs. Bernard leans forward just enough that Ryan can embrace her. Mr. Bernard swallows thickly as he reaches over to clutch his wife's hand in support. I shouldn't have come. I should have let Ryan handle this alone. Assured him it was a private matter, not a place for a stranger like me. But I was so desperate for any shred of information about the woman that I ignored the risk of what I could face here. Now I realize how big my mistake is. The officer who was sitting on the stool now has his sights set on us. And because it seems like the only thing stopping Mrs. Bernard from completely falling apart is Ryan's arms around her, the officer approaches me first.
Hello, he says, as he turns the pages in his notebook. I'm Deputy Bullock. I'm gathering as much information as I can. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
I'm stuck. I can't say I don't know anything, because obviously they were with us last night. And as much as I would like to answer those questions on my terms, now we'll have to do. Of course, I say, then nod toward Ryan. We rushed right over as soon as we heard what happened. James and Luca were at our house last night. With his pen poised over the clean sheet of paper, he asks,
And your name is?
I hesitate only a second before I answer, Evie Porter. I've now officially lied to the police.
Is Evie your full name or is it short for something else?
Evelyn.
Okay, Miss Porter. How did you know Mr. Bernard and Miss Marino?
Ryan disengages himself from Mrs. Bernard, promising her he will return shortly, then comes to stand next to me. His right arm slips around my waist.
and I'm not sure if he's trying to show a united front or if he needs any comfort I can give him.
Hi, I'm Ryan Sumner. James was an old friend of mine. Evie and I had him and Luca over for dinner last night.
Deputy Bullock scribbles away and doesn't look up when he asks the next question.
Was Miss Marino drinking last night?
Ryan looks at me before answering, the pause causing the deputy's pen to stop and his eyes to move from the notepad to us. She had one glass of wine when they first arrived, around 6, and then one more glass with dinner. James had a considerable amount more to drink, which is why she was driving, I answer. Deputy Bullock waits a beat, then goes back to his notes.
Would you say she seemed in control of her faculties when she left your home?
Yes,
Ryan answers.
Is it possible she had more to drink than you witnessed? Maybe she snuck another glass or two that you weren't aware of.
I guess it's possible, but I think that's unlikely. She was around us the entire evening, except for when she went to the bathroom.
Drunk driving is the most obvious reason for an accident like this. The question of her alcohol consumption will eventually be answered when the autopsy comes back. But I know she couldn't have had more than 2 glasses.
Did Mr. Bernard put up a fight about not being able to drive home?
He asks. Mrs. Bernard clutches her chest at his question. Ryan, realizing how upset she is, motions for us to move into the hallway.
No, not at all. He willingly and gladly got into the passenger seat,
Ryan finally says when we've cleared the room. The deputy nods. He's writing more than what we're saying, but the way the pad is angled, I can't see his notes.
How were things between Mr. Bernard and Miss Marino last night? Any arguing? Fighting?
No, not at all, I answer.
Anything happened that could have caused Miss Marino to be distracted? Upset?
The officer looks at Ryan, shrugging as he adds,
Any talk of old girlfriends? I know how reminiscent with old friends can be. Did she have to sit and listen to Mr. Bernard's glory days and maybe didn't like what she was hearing?
No, it wasn't anything like that,
Ryan says, his words tinged with anger.
Neither of us would have wanted Luca or Evie to be uncomfortable.
The officer holds a hand up.
Okay, I get it, but I have to ask. Just trying to figure out what was going on inside of her head while she was behind the wheel last night.
I know what was going through her head. I not only outed her, I all but threatened that Mr. Smith would turn on her as quickly as he turned on me. And Ryan had just told James he was done with him after he asked Ryan for money. Neither of them was in a good place.
What time did they leave your home?
He asks. A little before 11, I say. We answer every question, laying out the evening, starting with the dinner invitation made yesterday morning in Home Depot, all the way through our day, until we saw their taillights disappear down our quiet street. Deputy Bullock only looks up when Ryan stumbles over an answer, but mostly his haziness on the details comes from the fact that he matched James drink for drink, and I'm sure the evening is a bit blurry for him.
When was the last time you'd been in contact with Mr. Bernard before he came back to town?
Ryan stares off into the distance, seemingly lost in thought. He finally answers,
Maybe a year ago. He needed money. I sent it to him.
He keeps his answer to the bare minimum, and he doesn't mention James's most recent request for financial help. The deputy looks at me.
And when was the last time you've interacted with Mr. Bernard before his return home?
I shake my head. I just met him for the first time a week ago. Ryan adds before I can stop him.
Evie moved here from Brookwood, Alabama a few months ago. She didn't know James.
Oh, fuck. I watch as he scribbles down that last helpful tidbit from Ryan, hoping the background put in place for Evelyn Porter holds up. Finally, the deputy pockets his notebook and pen.
We'll be in contact if we have any further questions.
I nod, but Ryan stops him before he walks away.
Have you notified Luca's family yet?
His arm, which is still anchored around my waist, pulls me closer.
I thought they may want to talk with us since we were the last ones to see her. We've called the local police in Eden and are waiting for them to get back to us. They're trying to track down any relatives of hers now.
There are no relatives of Luca Marino in Eden, North Carolina, but he will find that out soon enough.
Well, if they have any questions or just want to talk, will you please forward my number to them? Ryan asks.
Deputy Bullock nods.
Of course.
We help the Bernards back into the main living room after the police depart. Even though there is a line of people wanting to offer their condolences, Mrs. Bernard latches onto Ryan again. He sits down beside her on the couch while she speaks to each person who steps forward. It seems we're stuck here for the foreseeable future. I opt to help out in the kitchen, where most of the church ladies have migrated. No one gossips more than God-fearing, casserole-toting women, so I settle near the coffee pot, offering to refill any mug that comes my way, and hope to hear something interesting until I see an opening to snoop the room James and the woman were staying in. There are three women in the kitchen with me. Francie seems to be the cook of the group and has taken the wild assortment of food that was brought in and divided it into portions that will go into the fridge for the Bernards to eat later. The other half is being put out buffet style on the dining room table for visitors to enjoy. Tony is what Mama called a latherer. She does a good job of looking busy without actually getting anything done. And Jane is the list master. There's a list of people to call, a list of things to buy, a list of dishes that have been dropped off, a list of people who have dropped by, and a list of people who will write notes to thank anyone who brought a dish or dropped by. Death requires a lot of organization. Francie disappears into the small laundry room off the kitchen for a few minutes, then reappears with a large basket of folded clothes.
I'm going to run these to James's room, she says.
It's clear the weight of the basket is more than she can manage, so I grab this opportunity.
Please let me help. I can handle this if you point me in the right direction, I say, my hands already on the basket.
Francie seems relieved.
Honey, that's sweet of you. These were James and Lucas' things. I didn't want Rose to have to fool with them just yet. His room is the second door on the right, she says, pointing to a hall off the kitchen.
I bolt out of the kitchen and down the hall. It's startling to see this room as they left it last night, thinking they would be back. After dropping the basket of clothes on the unmade bed, I spend time going through the papers on the small desk, but there's nothing of any significance there. Two open suitcases sit side by side on the floor next to the bed, with clothes spilling out. Toiletries and makeup litter the bathroom countertop. I dig through the woman's bag first, only finding clothes and shoes. I'm surprised they never unpacked, making use of the empty closet and chest, given how long they've been here. I run my fingers around the inside edge of her suitcase, stopping when I pass over a rough, raised area. I dig into the lining and find the Velcro closure, then see the familiar brown color of a 4x6 manila envelope as soon as I pry it open. The same type of manila envelope my instructions come in. I pull it out and open it, my heart pounding when I see the single sheet of paper still inside. Subject, Evie Porter. Since initial contact has been made, prepare to engage subject again. If the opportunity to enter subject's residence presents itself, use it to search her belongings. Concentrate on her personal space and possessions. Report anything that she deemed important enough to hide, regardless of what it is. When in doubt, document it and send it to me. Proceed with extreme caution when dealing with her things, and leave no trace behind. I study the outside of the envelope and see the address of a shipping store and the mailbox number 2870. He's desperate if he sent her to look through my stuff. He knows I wouldn't ever keep anything of value at Ryan's. Tucking the instructions back into the envelope, I fold it, then stuff it in the back pocket of my jeans.
Everything okay in here?
Francie asks from the open doorway, startling me. I glance at her over my shoulder while grabbing a stack of clothes I'd removed from the bag.
I thought I'd save Mrs. Bernard the trouble of repacking Luca's clothes, since I'm sure she'll need to send her stuff back to her family. I didn't want her to have to do it.
That gets me a big smile.
Oh, wonderful. I'll help you finish up in here. I'm hiding from Jane. She'll make me wash the dishes.
Francie and I spend the next 30 minutes getting all their belongings back into the two suitcases. I continue to search for the previous instructions and detailed description of me as the subject that she would have received. But I don't find anything else. I head out to the main room to look for Ryan.
I need to get out of here and go talk to the one person who can help me decide what to do next. Alias, Mia Bianchi, 6 years ago. There are lots of people trying to be the brightest and best help to Andrew Marshall. Smoke blowing and ass kissing are the two main qualities every employee and volunteer possesses. I decide to take the opposite route. It's risky for sure, but I don't care how inflated your ego is. Blunt honesty has more value than blind worship. And if Andrew's smart enough to get this far, he knows it. I'm currently embedded in Andrew Marshall's political campaign as he makes his bid for governor of Tennessee. When I got my first set of instructions for this job, which listed my new identity as Mia Bianchi and the address of my new apartment in Knoxville, Tennessee, there was a handwritten note on the bottom of the page that said, "You're moving to the big leagues, so don't fuck this up." Even though I've been working for Mr. Smith for a little over 2 years, I've never met him in person or talked to him on the phone since the Kingston job. So I'm guessing that added footnote was from Matt. Everything goes through Matt. The second set of instructions came a week after I settled in Knoxville. It listed Andrew Marshall as the mark and informed me that Mia Bianchi would start work on his campaign the next week. My hair, makeup, and clothing were to be flawless. I was to be the brightest person in the room. I was to make myself indispensable. There were 7 days to do a deep dive into Andrew Marshall's life and everyone associated with him, including his opponents, so I'd be ready for my first day on the job. Moving up is all I've wanted, so there was no way I wasn't going to be prepared. I've come a long way from that first job. I was reckless, just like Mr. Smith said. It was messy, and luck had been on my side. Jenny was in a medically induced coma for a week. The hit on the head mixed with all the drinking and pills made for a bad combination. When she came to, she had no memory of the entire 24 hours before the fall. I was in the clear. Or rather, Izzy Williams was. I've checked in on Miles a couple of times over the last 2 years. The Kingstons are divorced now, and it looks like Miles lives with Mr. Kingston and the latest Mrs. Kingston. The last time I stalked the new wife's Facebook page, there was a post she shared from an interior design company she'd hired to remove all traces of Jenny. The post showed interior shots of the newly renovated home, including one of Miles's room. When I zoomed in on the bookshelf, I spotted an origami swan sitting on one of the shelves. I'll never know if it was the same one I made with him that day, or if he's learned to make them on his own. But seeing that swan displayed as if it holds some importance is proof that I existed there, even if only for a very short amount of time. Maybe I'm not quite the ghost I thought I was. The Andrew Marshall job is the first time I've had to settle in, because I was told in the beginning it would be a couple of months before I got any further instructions. It is also the first job that came with a thick packet of cash for expenses, like rent and utilities, and other incidentals needed to become Mia Bianchi. This next rung on the ladder is pretty sweet. It's taken me 3 months, but now Andrew Marshall turns to me for my reaction on anything from which tie to wear to whether he should attend a certain event. A nod or quick shake of my head is all it takes to blow someone else's carefully made plans for him. Andrew Marshall is the only one okay with this. I don't need eyes in the back of my head to see the target painted there. His staff has dug into my background, trying to find anything that will knock me from my throne. But they've come up empty. I am Mia Bianchi. Even though I'm only 22, new hire paperwork shows I'm 27. The right clothes and makeup are key. I'm a graduate of Clemson University, go Tigers, and I excelled in my public policy classes and killed it on the debate team. I can't even begin to understand how someone was able to add my image into a pick of a debate against UNC a few years ago. But there it was. Just grainy enough that if you were looking for me, you'd find me, but not so clear as to draw questions from the students who were actually present. After 2 years of working with Matt, I know he isn't capable of what it would take to insert me so fully into this engineered life, and I grow more and more curious about the team behind Mr. Smith. I wonder how many people he has out there doing jobs like this. But those are ponderings for another day.
The subject up for debate today for Andrew Marshall is the American Bar Association event at some fancy hotel in Hilton Head, South Carolina. It's a weekend conference at which lawyers, including those like Andrew, who no longer practice but still keep their license up to date, will get continuing ed credits in between a morning round of golf and afternoon happy hour. It's as much for rubbing elbows and networking as it is for 30-minute crash courses, like the latest tech for small firms. And since my third set of instructions finally arrived and made it clear that Andrew most definitely should be there, that's what I'm pushing. But there is another opportunity for him, one that is better for his campaign, in Memphis at the same time. And given he's running for governor in Tennessee and not in South Carolina, it's an uphill battle. Andrew's wife, Marie, is wary of me. I have not given her a single reason to think I want her husband in any way. But women are funny. I don't have to give her a reason for her to still expect it. The surprising thing about Andrew Marshall is that he's a good man. I have searched through every file and personal record I can get my hands on. And since he doesn't suspect a thing from me, I've had access to all of it. There's not a hint of stealing or skimming money, no backdoor deals, no promises he wouldn't admit to publicly. He's as in love with his wife now as the day he met her, and he's good to his employees. Even his pets are rescue dogs. All my past jobs centered around me getting something Mr. Smith wanted or needed, whether it was computer files or documents or any other piece of physical goods or property. But this job was different from the beginning. Now I know why I'm here. Andrew Marshall will be the next governor of Tennessee, and Mr. Smith wants to own him on day one. Since there was no blackmail to be found, I will have to create it. His chief of staff has just finished laying out all the very good reasons to pick Memphis over Hilton Head. My very good reasons for picking the convention have already been laid out. The Hilton Head choice is a regional event, not just for South Carolina. And there will be some pretty big hitters attending, since the keynote speaker has just announced he's running for president. So media coverage will be on the national level. The networking and potential for new campaign donors is greater. And with social media transforming the landscape of politics the way it has, to become the governor of Tennessee, you need to think bigger than Tennessee. The room is quiet as everyone present waits for Andrew to either accept or reject the invitation to the Memphis event. Andrew knows my choice. He looks at me, and I've got a few seconds to decide if I'm going to help ruin a perfectly good man. A quick shake of my head seals his fate. Andrew believed I left for Hilton Head a day ahead of him and the rest of the team to get everything set up so we could make the most out of his time there. But that wasn't the reason I headed east a day early, and Georgia was my destination, not South Carolina. On Friday morning, I'm in Savannah, an hour south of Hilton Head, waiting for the first ride of the day on the hop-on, hop-off Old Town trolley. When it's time to board, I go straight to the back, taking the aisle seat on the last row on the driver's side, hoping no one asks to squeeze past me for the window seat. The tour company is efficient enough that we are loaded and on the move within a few minutes. An enthusiastic older man is on the mic, his booming voice so loud that not only the occupants of the bus, but everyone on the street we pass, get schooled on all things Savannah. By the time we finish the first loop, I'm the only passenger left from the group I started with, since the others disembarked at different stops along the route. On the second stop of my third pass, a tall, thin black man boards the bus and ambles down the center aisle, stopping in front of me. He's wearing an Atlanta Braves tee and hat, and his eyes are hidden behind dark sunglasses.
"Is that seat taken?"
he asks, pointing to the window seat I've been guarding. I pull my legs in tight and gesture for him to help himself. He scoots in past me, sits down, and sets his backpack in his lap. "Devin, I presume?" I say. I appreciate all the cloak and dagger, but I have a lot to do, and wasting 2 hours riding in a circle wasn't in my plans. He nods toward the speaker set in the ceiling of the trolley, and I notice for the first time the tiny little red light hiding behind the mesh material.
"You can tell a lot about a person by the way they act when they are left waiting too long."
I focus my attention back on him. I guess I passed.
His smirk appears for just a second, then it's gone.
With flying colors, Mrs. Smith.
It was probably dumb, but I couldn't resist using the same fake name my boss does. I found Devon on the internet a year ago when I was looking for some tech I couldn't get on my own that I needed for a job. This is the first time we're meeting in person, which is why he made me jump through hoops before showing his face. I appreciate the level of paranoia, though.
What is it you require, Mrs. Smith?
This is where it gets a little tricky. I'm not exactly sure yet. I have a job in Hilton Head, but won't get full instructions until I get there, and therefore won't know my needs. Once I do, I'll need it quick, so I'm asking that you be on hand to offer goods and support as needed. He looks out of the window and doesn't speak. It's a big ask, which is why I wanted to do it in person, rather than our usual channels of online communication. Since the night I was almost arrested at the country club, I've understood the value of having people in place to ensure someone will protect me if things go wrong. The help Mr. Smith sends will take care of me, as long as it doesn't hurt him, though. I need to have someone who's looking out for me, and only me. It's time I start building my own team. Finally, Devon turns back to me.
What if you require something I can't put my hands on at such short notice?
Then I'm hoping you can work the problem with me and offer another solution. He's looking out the window again while the trolley stops to load and unload passengers.
It sounds like you are expecting a problem, he says.
I nod, even though he's not looking at me. I am. Call it a gut instinct. The job is being set up by someone who doesn't understand the players as well as I do. I'm trying to get ahead of the moment when I'm presented with my instructions and determine the plan won't work.
This is not how I normally do things, he says.
I understand. I will make it worth your time. Also, if you ever need help from me, I will be there. He gets what I'm asking for. A partnership. We've had a solid working relationship the last year. He knows I pay well, and I know he delivers.
We are in a trial phase, Mrs. Smith. The first hint of a problem, and I'm gone.
I nod as I pass him a slip of paper from my bag that includes all pertinent information for the weekend. I wouldn't expect anything less. Just as the trolley stops, I ask one last question before I get off. How did I pass with flying colors?
You sat here like you had all the time in the world when I knew that wasn't the case. And that tells me everything I need to know.
Andrew Marshall and the rest of the team have arrived in Hilton Head. Once I get Andrew settled in his suite, I check into my much smaller room, four floors below. I've just kicked off my shoes and unzipped my bag when there is a quick knock on the door. A guy in the hotel's uniform smiles at me when I open the door. I look down at the domed covered plate that's sitting on the pushcart in front of him. Wrong room. I didn't order room service, I say, and go to close the door. The guy pushes the cart toward the door just enough to keep it from closing.
Matt sends this with his compliments.
His voice is low and deep. This stops me cold. I've never met anyone else who works for Matt. Doing a quick scan, this guy looks like he's in his mid-30s. His hair is short, streaked with gray around the temples, and he's only a few inches taller than me. The name tag on his uniform says George. His face and body are plain enough to make him easily forgettable. But the way his eyes never leave me ensures I won't. I pull the door open farther and motion for him to come inside. He parks the cart in the center of the room, then leaves without another word. Lifting the domed cover reveals a piece of carrot cake and an envelope similar to what I would typically find in the mailbox. It's unsettling that they know carrot cake is my favorite. I take the cake and the envelope to the small table so I can dig in while I see what's in store for the weekend. But after reading his instructions, I'm sure the chances of this plan working are slim. It's a weak plan, super weak, just as I feared it would be. Matt had bragged that he would be in charge on this job, which led me to believe Mr. Smith wanted to see what he was capable of. I guess I wasn't the only one moving up. But after dealing with Matt for the last 2 years, I wasn't confident he was ready to be let loose like this. So I reached out to Devin. The next time there's a knock on the door, I know what to expect. A bellhop, not the uniformed George, pushes a luggage cart into the room, then unloads 3 large boxes. I tip him and off he goes. I get the monitors set up and hook up the laptop, logging into the site on the paper I received earlier. The screen fills with small blocks, showing every angle of Andrew's room and balcony. Matt somehow got Andrew's wife, Marie, an invite to a very coveted event in Nashville to guarantee she won't be around when a woman approaches Andrew during the cocktail reception tonight to entice him to take her to his room. And I'll be there making sure it's all captured on camera. I'm almost offended by how dumb this plan is. Because what Matt doesn't understand is that if given the opportunity, Andrew will not cheat on his wife. It doesn't matter how many beautiful, scantily clad women throw themselves at him. It doesn't matter that he's got a room to himself. It doesn't matter how many drinks get fed to him. He's not a cheater. Matt didn't do his homework for this job, and it shows. But I can't come out of this weekend empty-handed. It's clear I'm playing a bigger game now, with a lot more at stake. I'm past petty theft. Relief that I brought Devin on board is the only thing that keeps me from panicking. I make the call, and within half an hour, we have a new plan. A better plan. While Devin scrambles to get what we need, I pick up my cell phone and call Andrew. He answers on the second ring.
Hey, he says. All settled in.
Andrew's room is one of the largest suites this hotel offers. There is a huge sitting area and dining room in addition to the bedroom. And there's a camera covering every inch, allowing me to watch as he paces the room, his phone to his ear. Yes, all settled. How about you? He drops down in one of the large chairs near the window.
Yes, all good here. Looking forward to a little downtime since I don't really need to be at the conference until tomorrow morning. I think I'll skip the cocktail thing tonight and just see everyone at breakfast. Plenty of time to rub elbows at the conference and the dinner tomorrow night. I'll just get some room service, then hopefully a good night's sleep.
And that's Andrew Marshall, squeaky clean and a tad dull. You know I'm supposed to fill every minute you're here with things that will help your campaign, I say, laughing into the phone. Especially since we pissed everyone off by coming here rather than Memphis. I see him hang his head low.
Mia, I need one night off.
Guilt bubbles to the surface until I remember the Kingston job. This is not my world. I'm just a ghost passing through. It's enough that I'm able to shove those feelings way down deep and press forward. How about this? I've looked at the list of attendees, and there are some big hitters here. Why don't I pick a handful for a private cocktail hour in your suite? Very low-key. Mingle with them for an hour, then I'll clear the room and let you have the rest of the night to yourself. Now his head is laying against the back of the chair, his hand rubbing his face.
1 hour.
Got it. I'll have room service send up a bar setup and some food. I disconnect the call and put the rest of my plan into place. Every man I invited to Andrew's private cocktail party jumped at the invitation. I was very particular with my list, choosing men from all over the South, since this was a regional conference and not just one for South Carolina. And since all my jobs from the last 2 years have taken place in the South, I'm up to date on the political climate in each state, including the good and bad on every big name here. Like Andrew, there are a handful of lawyers attending who also hold a range of elected positions, from local government office to the Senate. But I only invited the bad boys looking to play. The same ones who will quote the Bible along with their great love of family, faith, and God at their next rally. Might as well make the most of this for him politically while I'm at it. Andrew works the room with one eye on his watch as he counts down the minutes until this is over. The booze is flowing freely, thanks to the girls I brought in to serve it. I hand Andrew a beer, and he nods his thanks. He rarely drinks, but when he does, it's always a Miller Lite. Just one. He sips his beer, then says quietly,
"Not sure I would have invited Senator Nelson or Congressman Burke."
I'm not surprised by his comment. Both are self-serving pricks, but then so are all the men I've invited here tonight.
I know, but this is part of playing the game.
Like it or not, these are the guys who have the most pull.
I nod to one of the girls, and the music becomes a little louder. Ties are being loosened. Hands start to stray. Andrew senses the change in the party, and he looks at me in confusion. He's also sweating a little, his eyes glazing over. He leans in close.
Maybe we should call it a night. I'm not feeling good.
I give him a sympathetic look. You don't look good. Let's get you some air. I lead him to the balcony, then help him onto the lounge chair. By the time his head hits the headrest, he's out. The beer in his hand falls to the floor, the spiked liquid spreading across the tile. Sorry, Andrew, I whisper. Then head back into the party. It's time for the girls to make their move. Chapter 15, Present Day. As soon as I've finished packing up the woman's things, we're finally able to leave the Bernard's house after promising to come back tomorrow to help plan the memorial service for James. That's a visit I will happily let Ryan make alone, since I'd gathered everything I could on Luca from there. Ryan drives while I scroll Instagram, stopping on Southern Living's latest post, which showcases a beautiful front porch complete with a white wooden swing and hanging ferns. It's a gorgeous shot. Clicking the comment button, I type, "What a perfect spot for a get-together with a glass of wine. It's 5 o'clock somewhere." I keep scrolling once my comment loads until I'm all caught up, then stuff my phone in my purse. As soon as we enter Ryan's house, he launches himself on the couch in the den, landing face down. When I sit next to him, Ryan raises his head just enough for me to scoot closer so he can rest it on my lap. His eyes fall closed as I gently run my fingers through his hair. Neither of us feels the need to speak. As I stare down at him, I think about this latest development, now that the initial shock of their deaths has lessened. There are only two options to consider. First, the crash was a terrible accident that took the lives of two people. Second, killing them was a deliberate move by my boss. My gut is saying it's the second option, while my brain is trying to come up with the reasons why he would make that move. It didn't look like she was finished with this job. Her training for this identity, my identity, was extensive, and it seems premature to take her out now. And why kill them instead of just pulling them from the job? I can't get past the timing. What does killing them accomplish? Luca Marino from Eden, North Carolina, is dead. I made no secret that I fiercely protected my true identity. In that first year, Matt would start every conversation with small talk when he would call to discuss my next job. And I was dumb enough to believe we were friends. My plans of reclaiming my identity to live as Luca Marino were the one constant topic. I even told him about the house I would build and the garden I would plant. But her death does not stop me from reclaiming the Luca Marino identity. It makes it difficult, but not impossible. Killing her off was an extreme move, and not one Devin or I anticipated. Mr. Smith said she was sent as a reminder, but I didn't need a reminder of how dangerous this game is. Which brings me back to the possibility, and hope, that it really was an accident. And then there's Ryan. What does it mean for this job if it wasn't an accident? His grip on me loosens, and he lets out a soft snore. Today took a toll on him. Slowly, I unlatch Ryan from my waist and slide out from underneath him, replacing my lap with a throw pillow. Between the hangover I know he had this morning and the stress of the day, he doesn't even flinch. A glance at the clock on the oven tells me it's time to get going. I hope Devin will be waiting for me, so we can go over everything that has happened in the last 24 hours. In 6 years of working together, Devin and I have come a long way. He knows exactly who I am and where I came from. And I have made the extremely short list of those he has trusted with who he really is and the details of his past. In fact, I believe there are only three of us on that list. Pulling out my phone, I open Instagram. I have zero posts and a handful of followers who are mostly bots.
But I follow Devin's bogus account, plus 47 others, 90% of them businesses or famous personalities that post every day. Out of the 47 accounts my bogus account follows, 32 of them are also followed by Devin's. And even though I posted my comment on Southern Living's latest post, letting him know I needed to meet up with him tonight at 5, he will answer me in a comment on a completely different account, so no one would be able to link our comments as communication between the two of us. His paranoia knows no bounds. I can't give him a hard time about that, though, because there is no telling how many times his protocols have saved us in the past, and we didn't even know it. Scrolling through my feed, I stop when I get to the New Orleans Saints account and see the comment from skate_life831043. This comment from Devin is the only one visible on my feed, since we follow each other and also mutually follow this account. So I'm saved from having to scroll through hundreds of comments to find his. His comment reads, "Who dat? That's my third favorite player right there. Hashtag right on time." First thing Devin does when I get the details on a new job is scope out 5 places where he's comfortable for us to meet. The third one on the list he gave me when we got to Lake Forbing is the coffee shop on Main. His hashtags always either confirm the meeting time works or give me an alternative. I have 30 minutes to get there since he'll be hashtag right on time. I pull a sheet of paper off the pad near the fridge and leave Ryan a note that I've gone to pick us up some food, then slip out of the house. I'm 5 minutes early, but I see Devin has beat me here. It took 2 years for Devin to share the first personal detail about himself. We were going over blueprints for an office building I needed to get inside of after hours, and he recognized a name from a list of people who had offices on the floor I was trying to access.
"He's a tech guy. Spoke at MIT when I was there," he had said.
I didn't want to pry, but I also wanted to learn as much about him as I could. So I attempted a joke, hoping to get more out of him. "Were you solving his complicated equations on the whiteboard in the hall?" His stare made me think I'd taken the wrong approach, but then he laughed, a real laugh. And that broke the ice between us. The details were still given to me in small pieces, but now I have the full picture of who he really is. Devin is sitting at the counter that runs along the entire back wall. These spots are mostly used by individuals or couples, since the seating is not conducive to conversation with anyone other than the person sitting right next to you. He's working one of those complicated Kokoro puzzle books he loves, and wearing those huge over-the-ear-style headphones, his head and shoulders moving to a beat, even though I know there's no music coming through the speakers. His IQ is off the charts. If he's awake, he's got to keep that brain busy, like with the book in front of him. He started at MIT when he was 17, but he said he knew he wouldn't last long there. Not that he couldn't handle the workload, but more because he was bored out of his mind. His words. What sealed it was when he was given an assignment to build a network system for a simulated online advertising company, only to discover it was a real business, and his teacher was getting his students to do all the work for his side gigs. The free enterprise system being what it is, he went straight to the client and made a deal to sell it to him directly at a slightly reduced rate, then clued in every other student in the class, who followed suit. Then he was in business. It didn't take him long to find the most profitable work isn't always legal. His greatest success was retrieving info people didn't even know they needed, then offering it to them for an attractive price. He loves moving around in those dark places. Thrives on getting around systems meant to keep him out. And if you prove to be loyal to him, he will forever be loyal to you. I order a cappuccino, then make my way toward him. I choose a stool that leaves an empty space between us. He doesn't look in my direction when he says,
"I'm tapped into the coroner's office, so I'll have a copy of her dental records as soon as they're uploaded. I don't think a match will pop, but you never know."
I give him a small nod, but don't look at him either. It won't pop. Mr. Smith wouldn't be so sloppy. I hate that we may never know who she really was. And we're sure it's really her? That she really died in that wreck? This is something he would already have verified, but I still have to ask. He nods, and that's all I need to know he's sure that the body in the morgue is hers. I found the last set of instructions he gave her. I tell him. Devin turns a page in his book as he asks,
What did it say?
I pull it from my back pocket and slip it inside of a discarded magazine, then toss it in the empty space between us. He won't take it until I'm gone. You can see for yourself. But he basically told her to make contact, search my room if she can. It's pretty vague. And she did exactly as he asked. I left something for her to find.
I don't like this. Not at all.
He says quietly. You don't think it was an accident? He shakes his head just enough to let me know he doesn't. But why? Do you think she finished her job and we just don't know it?
Or she screwed up and he took her out.
What do you think James's part was in this?
Pawn,
Devin says, without even thinking about it.
Extensive drug and gambling problem, in dire need of funds, ridiculously easy to manipulate. Wouldn't be surprised if Smith wasn't behind the dad's broken leg to get him here.
Jesus, I hadn't thought of that possibility. And do we think Ryan is involved in this more than just an unsuspecting Mark? We had a conversation before I was sent here and knew who the Mark was. Also discussed the possibility that this whole job was just a ruse. Once we found out I was assigned to Ryan, Devin dug as deep as he could on him. Mr. Smith's notes he sends on a job don't compare to what Devin gives me. We learned about his business and how successful it has become. It made sense someone would want it. Mr. Smith had used Ryan's transport services a few years ago to move things on a few jobs I was a part of. So it's easy to see how Ryan was on his radar. Devin's shoulders shuffle back and forth a couple of times, as if he's trying to determine how he feels about the subject.
First, we know anything is possible, right?
Right.
So knowing anything is possible, it's still a long shot in my opinion. Regardless of the shady shit Ryan is going on, he is too rooted in this community, which goes against everything Mr. Smith looks for and the people he recruits to work for him.
I was a nobody without family or connections. There would be no flags raised if I disappeared. No one to seek out justice for me if things go sideways. This is not true for Ryan. He lives in a house where his neighbors have literally watched him grow up from infancy.
We deal in facts, and we don't have any that point in that direction, he says.
We sit in silence for a minute or so, both contemplating this latest development. Finally, I say, I cornered her in the kitchen. Told her I knew who she worked for. Told her she could very easily find herself in my position. His pencil stops moving for the first time since I sat down.
L, why?
L is the closest he'd ever come to saying Luca. Since it's such an uncommon name, and anyone listening would assume my name is L. But even with that precaution, Devin hardly ever addresses me directly. So I feel the weight behind it. I needed to know if she thought I was a random Mark, or if she knew I worked for him too. She didn't, by the way. The surprise on her face was real, and it's not like I discovered some big secret, since he already admitted to sending her. Devin's pencil goes back to work, and he bounces his head to the assumed beat.
Smith's greatest achievement is keeping everyone under him in line by keeping them blind to everything and everyone else in his organization. No one knows who he is. No one knows where they are in the chain.
Mr. Smith is the puzzle Devin has been working on for years. And the cops are aware of the name Evie Porter of Brookwood, Alabama. I add in a near whisper, as if I'm confessing my sins. This admission makes his face turn toward me.
Details?
I fill him in on our visit to the Bernard's house and the conversation with the police while he works diligently on the page in front of him. When I finish, he says,
I don't like this. I don't like that I can't see where this is going. I think we bail.
This gives me pause. We have found ourselves in a lot of situations where a positive outcome seemed doubtful, but he's never mentioned bailing before. And then what? We knew coming in he was pissed I didn't get the blackmail info on Connolly back for him. We also knew he's trying to determine if I actually was successful, but kept everything for myself. If Mr. Smith wants to take me out, bailing won't stop him. But it severely limits where I can go from here, especially now that Luca Marino doesn't exist anymore.
I still don't like it, he says. You're going to be a sitting duck while you wait for the next set of instructions. And what if they never come?
The only choice I have is to continue moving forward.
We both sit in silence for a minute or so, lost in our own thoughts. Then I ask, how's Heather? He ducks his head, and I think he's going to ignore me, but finally says,
good. She's good.
We stay the course, Devin. That's the only answer. He hesitates just a moment, then says,
got the details on the next big shipment coming through Glenview Trucking this Thursday. It's in the People magazine in front of you.
Good. I think it will confuse Smith when he sees I'm still working this job, even after that woman's death. Somewhere between the first and second round of delivering the information on Ryan's business to Mr. Smith, I was regretting the part I was playing. Maybe it was the daydreams that Ryan's home could really be mine, or the wishing this identity was real. But in a particularly weak moment, I altered a few key data points on the financials and client names before turning them over. It's not enough that Mr. Smith would notice, but just enough to give Ryan a fighting chance at keeping his business. I plan to make similar modifications to this latest set of information before passing it along. Devin doesn't know I've done this, and I feel bad keeping it from him. He would think I was taking an unnecessary risk. I'll drop it by the mailbox on my way home. Devin's head turns just slightly in my direction.
That's not your home, Elle.
I flinch at his words, then grab the magazine in front of me, shoving it in my bag. I pick up my cup and stand from my stool. I'll be in touch. Just as I start to walk away, he whispers,
please be safe.